Last Sunday, we were looking at Ezra in this study on suffering and deliverance, and we saw how Ezra led the people back to, he led them in the rebuilding effort of Jerusalem after the 70-year Babylonian captivity. And though he was given license from the king, Cyrus, to do so, he had a lot of enemies, and we saw as we went through it that it was just one roadblock after another, and yet the Lord delivered them out of them all. It reminds me of the passage in Psalm which says, many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivereth them out of them all. Well, now we're going to go to Nehemiah, and Nehemiah was somewhat of a contemporary or close in time to Ezra anyway. I think from how I read it here, I think the events of Nehemiah happened after the events of Ezra, and I'll get into that, into why that is here in just a minute. But in the days of Nehemiah, the Jews faced obstacles when they worked to finish rebuilding the temple, just like they had earlier in the days of Ezra. And Nehemiah was a cupbearer to the king Artaxerxes. He was one of the Medo-Persian kings. In Nehemiah 1 and verse 11, Nehemiah says, O Lord, I beseech thee, let now thine ear be attentive to the prayer of thy servant and to the servant and to the prayer of thy servants who desire to fear thy name and prosper. I pray thee, thy servant this day, and I pray thee, thy servant this day, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man, for I was the king's cupbearer. I really could have just read the last sentence there. That's what I really wanted. He was the king's cupbearer, which means that he stood before the king and presented the king with his cup and his drink. And he might have even been the guy that took a sip of it before the king did to make sure it wasn't poisoned and, you know, that kind of thing. So Nehemiah found out about the suffering of the Jews who had returned to Jerusalem to rebuild, and how the walls in Jerusalem had been burned with fire, and he was very grieved about this. And we read about this in the first four verses of the chapter here. Nehemiah 1, verses 1 through 4. It says, the words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah, and it came to pass in the month Kislew, in the 20th year, as I was in Shushan the palace. You remember Shushan the palace from Esther when we looked at that. This is probably around the same time period as that was. That Hanani, one of my brethren, came, he and certain men of Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews that had escaped, which were left of the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said unto me, the remnant that are left of the captivity that there in the province are in great affliction and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem also is broken down, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. And it came to pass, when I heard these words, that I sat down and wept and mourned certain days and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Now, I made this point in the Daniel, in the series on the 70 weeks prophecy in Daniel, and when we were looking at the decree to rebuild Jerusalem and who gave that decree, and some people think that it was given here by Artaxerxes to Nehemiah, and I gave my reasons why I don't believe that's so, and this is one of them here, because Nehemiah hears about the plight of the people in Jerusalem and how the wall's been broken down and burned with fire. And he's greatly distressed, and he's mourning and weeping about this. Well, if you think about it, if this is referring to the Babylonian destruction of the wall in Jerusalem, that happened 70-some years prior to that, before Nehemiah would have even been born. Nehemiah obviously would have known, and had known his entire life, about the destruction of Jerusalem. That's why he's in the Medo-Persian Empire, right? I mean, obviously, he knew about the destruction of Jerusalem. It would have been absolutely impossible for him not to have known about it. So for him to hear about an event that happened 70-some years or more ago, and then to be weeping and wailing about that, I mean, it'd be like somebody telling me, hey, you know, in the 1860s, there was a civil war, and 400 and some thousand Americans died. And I'm like, oh, this is horrible. And I just fall on my face and start crying. It's like, well, yeah, that's 150-some years ago. I don't believe that's what was being reported to him here at all. What was being reported to him was fresh news about what was happening to the people that had returned to rebuild Jerusalem. And apparently, some of their adversaries had been successful, and I am speculating a bit, but apparently they'd been successful in destroying part of the wall and making breaches in the wall that had been in the process of being rebuilt. And I gave more reasons for that in that series. So that's what I think is going on here. I don't think this is referring to the destruction in 70 AD. And furthermore, in 70 AD, is my understanding, that wall and the whole city was completely wiped out, completely leveled. Well, when Nehemiah goes back, he's rebuilding the breaches in the wall. There are part of the wall that is left that had been destroyed, and he's repairing it. And you see in Nehemiah, as I pointed out in that series, numerous times they repaired the wall. Repairing something is fixing something that is broken, not starting from scratch. So anyway, I don't need to re-preach that sermon, but that's what's going on here, as far as I can tell. Well, when the king saw that Nehemiah was sorrowful, then he inquires why. And when he inquires, Nehemiah tells him what's going on, and he asked him if he could go back to Jerusalem to rebuild the city. This is in chapter 2, 1 through 5. And it came to pass in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes the king, that wine was before him, and I took up the wine and gave it unto the king. Now I had not been beforetime sad in his presence. Wherefore the king said unto me, Why is thy countenance sad, seeing thou art not sick? This is nothing else but sorrow of heart. Then I was very sore afraid. Apparently it was not a good thing to be sad in front of the king. The king wants to be happy, and he wants to have happy people around him. And if you're going to bring the king down, you might be in big trouble. The king's perceptive here, obviously. He's not just one that is, you know, that things go right over his head when he sees somebody that's not feeling well. He could figure that out. Verse 3, And said unto the king, Let the king live forever. Why should not my countenance be sad when the city, the place of my father's sepulchres, lieth waste, and the gates thereof are consumed with fire? Then the king said unto me, For what dost thou make request? So I prayed to the God of heaven. This is one of those situations where I assume it was a Lord help kind of prayer that you say within yourself in a split second before you go ahead and make your request. I highly doubt that Nehemiah went over to his prayer closet and took 15 minutes and came back to the king, right? Probably a very quick, help me Lord prayer. And you'll see, as you read through the book of Nehemiah, you'll see Nehemiah probably above anybody else in scripture that I can think of was a man of prayer. That every time something happens, Nehemiah prays to the God of heaven. You'll see that many, many times through this book. It's a good lesson for us to remember, because, well, I think most of you are probably like me. A lot of times when something major happens or some catastrophe happens, it's only long after we've thought about a million things that we could do or should do or might do, and then we finally think, oh yeah, maybe I should pray about this. So it's a good lesson for us. Verse 5, And I said unto the king, If it please the king, and if thy servant have found favor in thy sight, that thou wouldest send me unto Judah, unto the city of my father's sepulchres, that I may build it. Well, this is a good example of asking, and I'll get to that in the lessons. But Nehemiah just simply asked. The king said, What would you like to do? And he didn't have anything to lose, and he figures, well, I'll just ask, see if I can take a sabbatical from my job here and go back and rebuild Jerusalem. And the king granted his request, and he provided him timber to rebuild the wall. So he gave him his request, and he gave him more than he requested. Right? Doesn't it say that God is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think? Nehemiah just asked if he could go build, and the king says, yeah, and I'm going to give you all the supplies you need to do it as well. Nehemiah 2, 6 through 8. And the king said unto me, the queen also sitting by him, For how long shall thy journey be, and when wilt thou return? So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. Moreover, I said unto the king, If it please the king, let letters be given me to the governors beyond the river, that they may convey me over till I come into Judah. So as he's going through these other lands and nations and getting across the river, across the Jordan, into the land of Judah, he wants to have letters in case somebody asks him, what are you doing? Why are you here? You know, he can say, hey, King Artaxerxes sent me. And, you know, he can continue on his way. Verse 8. And a letter unto Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the palace which appertain to the house, and for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall enter into. And the king granted me according to the good hand of my God upon me. So he did ask for the timber. But still, I mean, the king gave him, you know, a lot more than he could have expected. Now, when Nehemiah arrived in Jerusalem, his adversaries, two clowns named Sanballat and Tobiah, they were grieved that he was there to seek the welfare of his people. You're always going to have some people that just can't be happy for anybody else. Of course, they don't want to see the Jews doing well. Nehemiah 2, we're going to go down to verses 9, and 9 and 10. Then I came to the governors beyond the river, and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent captains of the army and horsemen with me. So he shows up there with a little company of men, and that probably really irritated these Sanballat and Tobiah, because he's coming there, he's got the king's authority, he's got the king's men with him, and they're like, oh man, what are we going to do now? When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the servant, the Ammonite, heard of it, it grieved them exceedingly that there was come a man to seek the welfare of the children of Israel. Yeah, anytime some man comes to try to have mercy upon the people of the land, the powers that be get upset about that. Look what happened in Canada. These truckers actually cared about the people and the people's liberty, and that wicked government up there pulled out all the stops and sent in the goons and started beating them until they finally went home. So yeah, nothing new under the sun. So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Well, they're first going to start out just by simply mocking Nehemiah. They're not going to resist him physically yet. We'll get to that. But they're going to start out by just mocking him, laughing at him, and trying to dissuade him that way when they hear about these plans to rebuild the wall. Jump down to verse 19. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the servant, the Ammonite, and Geshem the Arabian heard it, they laughed us to scorn and despised us and said, what is this thing that ye do? Will ye rebel against the king? So they laughed him to scorn. They make fun of him. They jeer at him and snicker at him and try to make him feel like he's not going to be able to accomplish his task. He's got no chance. But, you know, Nehemiah was totally undeterred by this. He just remained resolute in the faith. He wasn't going to let these guys mocking him stop him from what he had been commissioned to do. And that's a good lesson for us. You want to remember that. We'll get to that at the end. Verse 20. Then answered I them and said unto them, the God of heaven, he will prosper us. See, his faith is in God. His faith isn't even in King Artaxerxes. His faith is in God. God will prosper us. Therefore, we his servants will arise and build. But ye have no portion, nor right, nor memorial in Jerusalem. You guys have no business being here. This one guy's a Horonite, the one guy's an Ammonite, the one guy's an Arabian. Like, go back where you guys came from. You got no business here. This is our land, Nehemiah is telling him. This has been given to us by God. So he was not deterred. You got to remember that. You got to be resolute in the faith, because there's always going to be troubles. There's always going to be problems. There's always going to be roadblocks. And if you're the kind of person that every time some little roadblock gets put in your way and you just say, well, I tried, I can't do it, you're not going to get very far. You have to persevere through the troubles and the problems of life, or else you're just going to fall into despair and despondency, and you're going to be unprofitable. If you want to be fruitful, you've got to keep pushing. doing what God told you to. Not what you want to do, necessarily, but what God told you to do. Well, when they continued to rebuild, their enemies again mocked them and tried to discourage them. Let's go to chapter 4. In chapter 3, you read about how they were repairing the different gates and things in the wall. And in chapter 4, the enemies come back again, and now they're going to mock them and discourage them once more. Nehemiah 4, 1 through 3. But it came to pass that when Sanballat heard that we builded the wall, he was wroth and took great indignation and mocked the Jews. He's wroth. That means he's really mad. Wroth is a past tense of cognitive wrath. He's full of wrath. He's really upset. Great indignation. And so what's he do? He mocks them again. He makes fun of them. He tries to make them feel stupid, right? Make them feel like they can't do it. I mean, let me keep reading, and then I will comment. And he spake before his brethren and the army of Samaria, and said, "What do these feeble Jews? Will they fortify themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they make an end in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish which are burned?" Now Tobiah the Ammonite was by him, and he said, "Even that which they build, if a fox go up, he shall even break down their stone wall." What will these feeble Jews do? Look at these guys, pathetic. They don't even know what they're doing. Bunch of weaklings. They're going to build this wall. It's going to be such a piece of junk that even if a fox jumps on it and walks across it, he's going to end up just crumbling the whole thing. It's just going to fall down under the weight of a fox. This thing's going to be totally worthless. What do these guys think they're doing? They're trying to make fun of them. Make them feel inadequate. You know, like somebody might say, "How many people do you have in your church?" Oh, really? Oh, that many, huh? Wow. You must have some pastor, huh? Right? I mean, that's what people think. But that's all right. I remain undeterred, just like Nehemiah. So Nehemiah responded to the reproach by praying to God for help. As I mentioned to you a minute ago, this is Nehemiah's first go-to. Every time some trouble comes, he gets on his knees and he prays. Verses 4 and 5. He says, "Hear, O our God, for we are despised, and turn their reproach upon their own head, and give them for a prey in the land of captivity." You know, Nehemiah was in good company here, because Jesus Christ was despised and afflicted, we're told. "And cover not their iniquity, and let not their sin be blotted out from before thee, for they have provoked thee to anger before the builders." This is what you call an imprecatory prayer. Now he's praying against them. You ever wonder why I've prayed publicly that God would send fire down from heaven and destroy these wicked people who persecuted us? Well, right there you go. I have biblical justification for it. "So built we the wall." Do I want verse? No, I only wanted, I'll get to verse 6 here in a minute. So Nehemiah, in the face of this derision and this scoffing and scorning and mockery, he doesn't give it back in kind. He doesn't start calling them names. He goes to God in prayer. And you know what he did? He ignored his enemies. He just didn't pay any attention to them. He didn't even respond to them. He talks to God instead. And I recommend this. I recommend ignoring your enemies. For one thing, it'll drive them crazy. They'll hate that when you do that. You know, isn't that one thing that our parents taught us or should have taught us? Probably most of our parents taught us. When people pick on you and when they bully you, ignore them. And they'll stop. I mean, they'll keep picking for a little while. But it doesn't take very long before they realize, "I can't get a rise out of this guy. I'm going to move on and start picking on somebody else." Some people never learned that lesson as a kid. Just ignore them. If you're going to let somebody hurt you every time they say some mean thing against you, you're always going to be hurt. You've got to have some thick skin. And I did this recently. Someone just recently attacked me and accused me of being a greedy pastor, a greedy dog that coerces his people into giving him money. Yeah, somebody Somebody attacked me of this. Seriously. No, I'm not even joking. No, he did. Tore into me in an email. Of course, this guy knows nothing about me. Doesn't know me. Never met me. Didn't bother to ask any questions or anything. He's read a couple of sermons, outlines or something that I did and assumed that he understood what I was talking about and apparently didn't. But anyway, really tore into me, slandered me, said a bunch of nasty stuff about me. And then he was nice enough to put the correspondence on his website for the whole world to read. And, I responded briefly to one of the things he said. And then when he really tore into me, I just didn't respond. I didn't respond. I just said, you know, I don't have time or inclination to respond to all these slander and false accusations. I have better things to do. Now, if he slandered you, or if he slandered God, or was, you know, arguing against the truth or something, that's different. But if he's just going to say nasty things about me, I've got better things to do than to defend myself. So I didn't. But I do feel bad for the poor guy, and I think I may actually call him up and see if he'll talk to me on the phone, because I read about him on his site, and I don't know. There might be some hope for the guy. You never know. So anyway, I may give him a call one of these days and see. But you know, you don't have to defend yourself. When Jesus Christ was brought up before Pilate and the Jews accused him of all kinds of stuff and said all kinds of false things about him, you know what his defense was? Silence. He said nothing. You don't have to defend yourself. You can if you want to, but you don't have to. Well, the people, getting back to Nehemiah, the people had a mind to work, and they just kept building despite of the adversity. Nehemiah 4 and verse 6. He says, So built we the wall, and all the wall was joined together unto the half thereof, for the people had a mind to work. That last phrase there is so important. The people had a mind... a mind to work. When people have a mind to work, you can get a lot of things done. If you don't have a mind to work, and you just go about things lackadaisically and haphazardly, and you just, you know, lazily, things don't get done. But when people have a mind and a purpose, and they want to get something done, then things get done. They just kept building, and they joined the walls together. They paid no attention. And that's why I didn't bother going through this guy's email point by point and saying, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, you don't know what you're talking about. Why? I've got bigger things, I got more important things to do. Why would I waste my time with something like that? Well, this made their enemies even more furious, and they conspired to fight against them to hinder the rebuilding effort. So this makes people mad. When you won't respond to them, when you won't waste your time fighting with them, and you just keep doing the work that God's given you to do, this infuriates them even more. And that's why this guy comes back to, getting back to this other situation, he goes back to the thread after he'd posted it for a couple of weeks, and there were no more posts on there. A couple other people had some nice things to say too. Then he goes back, I was just thinking about this, you know, and Wagner hasn't even responded to any of this, and he hasn't changed, da, da, da. And I'm thinking, man, you're still, 2 weeks later, and you're still thinking about this? It drives people crazy whenever you won't take the bait. Okay, so they get even more angry, and now they conspire to fight against them to hinder the rebuilding effort. Before, up until now, they've just been using the mockery tactic. When that didn't work, now they're actually going to get physical about it. Nehemiah 4, 7 through 8. But it came to pass that when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabians and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were made up and that the breaches began to be stopped, then they were very wroth and conspired all of them together to come and to fight against Jerusalem and to hinder it. So now they're actually going to pull out their weapons and start to physically fight against this to try to stop it from happening. Well, guess what Nehemiah did? Just take a wild guess. He prayed. But he didn't stop there. Praying is good and necessary. But if all you think you're going to do is pray, and God's going to take care of everything for you without you lifting a finger and doing anything for yourself, you're wrong. Nehemiah prayed and set a watch. Very important. Verse 9. Nevertheless, despite all these people gathering together against us to fight with us, nevertheless, we made our prayer unto our God and set a watch against them day and night because of them. He didn't just pray. He set a watch. That is soldiers that were there on a night watch to make sure that nobody comes in and does them harm. That's why we pray that the house doesn't burn down, but we also buy house insurance, right? Something like that. That kind of idea. You pray that you don't die an early death and leave your wife and family destitute, but then you buy life insurance, right? If you're in that stage of life where people are depending on you, right? You pray and then you do something about it. Nehemiah set up armed men to protect the workers. Nehemiah 4:13-16. Therefore set I in the lower places behind the wall, and on the higher places, I even set the people after their families with their swords, their spears, and their bows. So he has armed men of the people in the low places and the high places, swords and spears and bows. It says with their swords and their spears and their bows. These people had weapons and they knew how to defend themselves. There's another good lesson for us. People, especially men, should have weapons, should know how to use them, should know how to defend themselves. In verse 16, and it came to pass that from that time forth, that the half of my servants wrought in the work, and the other half of them held both the spears and the shields and the bows and the habergeons, and the rulers were behind all the house of Judah. So half of them work, half of them defend the other half that's working. This is what you call trusting in God and using personal responsibility to take care of yourself. Just trusting in God is not going to cut it. You've got to do what you need to do to take care of yourself. And then God will bless it. He also armed the men who did the work on the wall so that they could defend themselves. Look at verses 17 and 18. They which builded on the wall, and they that bear burdens with those that laded, every one with one of his hands wrought in the work, and with the other hand held a weapon. For the builders, every one had his sword girded on his side, and so builded. And he that sounded the trumpet was by me. These guys took their guns to work with them. One hand, they've got their weapon. One hand, they've got their tool that they're using to build the wall, which would have obviously hindered their building effort, but you got to do what you got to do. I am an advocate of carrying your gun to work with you. Some employers don't allow that, and that's up to you whether you want to obey that or not, but I think it's a good policy. Nehemiah did. Nehemiah trusted that God would fight for them and bless their efforts. Look at verse 20. In what place thereof ye hear the sound of the trumpet, resort ye thither unto us, for God, our God shall fight for us. He believed that God would fight for him. But he also knew that God required him to fight. And when you fight, God will take up your side in the fight. If you just stand there and assume God's going to do all the fighting for you, and you don't have to do anything, like I said, you're wrong. Turn to Proverbs 21 and verse 31. This principle is summed up quite well in this proverb. Proverbs 21:31. The horse is prepared against the day of battle, but safety is of the Lord. There's two extremes to be careful to avoid here. There's the one that says, I'm just going to trust God. Everything's going to be all right. God's going to take care of me and do nothing to provide for your own needs. That's an error. There's another one which says, I'm going to take care of myself and I'm going to provide for all of my needs and I'm going to have my guns and I'm going to have my gold and I'm going to have my whatever. I'm going to have everything. I'm going to be a doomsday prepper. I'm going to be totally self-sufficient. And come what may, I am going to make sure that I am going to be okay through my own strength. I'm going to make it happen. And not relying on God. See, those are the two extremes. The middle of the road is right here. The horse is prepared against the day of battle. Prepare that horse. Prepare to defend yourself, to provide for yourself, to take care of yourself. But trust in the Lord. Safety is of the Lord. All right, back to Nehemiah. When mocking and fighting against Nehemiah and the Jews didn't work, next they attempted to prevent him from building by trying to distract him, by getting him to meet with them. This is their third tactic. They tried mockery twice. They tried physically assaulting him. That didn't work. Now they're going to try to distract him. And this is a good tactic. If you can get somebody distracted, well then, they're not going to get the work done. That's just like this guy I was telling you about. He wanted to waste my time. I don't know if that was his aim or not, but what would have happened if I would have spent 2 hours responding to this email, defending myself from a bunch of false accusations, what would that have proved? Nothing, because he probably wouldn't have been convinced anyway. It would have just been a big waste of my time. Nehemiah 6, 1 through 2. You know what he accused me of, by the way? I don't know why I'm talking about this. You know what, one of the things he accused me of? He said that he saw in my outline that you're supposed to give to the ministry and that the pastor is also required to give to God. And so what I do is, when I pass the plate around here, you know the plate that we pass all the time, that I like put a gun to your head and make you put money in? You know that plate that doesn't exist in this church, right? That one. When I pass the plate around that doesn't exist to fund the church building that we don't have, right? What I do is I take the money out of the plate and then I tithe back to God by putting the money back in the plate. So I take money out of the plate that's given to me and then I tithe back into the plate, but then it just goes back to me anyway. That's what I do. Did you know that? You were unaware of that. Go talk to this guy. He apparently knows what's really going on around here. This is the kind of nonsense I'm talking about. Okay, where was I? Nehemiah 6, 1 through 2. It says, now it came to pass when Sanballat and Tobiah and Gershom, the Arabian, and the rest of our enemies heard that I had builded the wall and that there was no breach left therein, though at that time I had not set up the doors upon the gates, that Sanballat and Geshem sent unto me, saying, come, let us meet together in some one of the villages in the plain of Ono. And you know what Nehemiah said? Ono. Oh, but they thought to do me mischief. They say, hey, Nehemiah, let's get together here. Come on out to the plain of Ono and we can talk. You know, just have a little powwow. Nehemiah says, nope, I know what's going on here. These guys are thinking of doing me mischief. Nehemiah didn't know what it was, but he's like, there's some reason that these guys that hate me so much, they've been making fun of me for a long time now. They've been setting up this assault against me, and now all of a sudden they want to go out to the plain of Ono and have a little chat. I don't think this is all above board here. Nehemiah was a prudent, insightful man, although I don't think it would have exactly taken, you know, an Einstein IQ to figure out what these guys were up to in this case. Well, Nehemiah saw through their ruse, and he told them that he was doing a great work, and he didn't have time to waste with them. Verse 3. And I sent messengers unto them, saying, I am doing a great work, so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it and come down to you? Just remember that verse. I am doing a great work. And just remember that. That applies to every one of us. Every one of us has a work of God to do in our lives, whatever that might be. I am doing a great work. Therefore, I cannot come down to you. I am not going to be distracted and be drawn away into controversies that are going to take me away from the great work that God has given me to do. As a matter of fact, just turn with me to, I think it's in 2 Timothy. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 4. This is talking about the pastor. It says, no man that warreth entangleth himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who hath chosen him to be a soldier. A pastor should not be entangling himself in the affairs of this life. I have a great work to do. I can't be wasting my time with the affairs of this life. I had thought about running for school board. You say, why in the world would you do that? You don't even have kids and you hate public schools. I know that, but those people on the school board made me so darn mad that I wanted to go there and just throw a wrench in their whole system. And I wanted to be the guy that tries to stop everything evil that they're doing and bring it to public light and all that kind of thing. But then I remembered, I am doing a great work, and no man that warreth entangleth himself with the affairs of this life. And why would I waste my time trying to reform a corrupt system like that anyway? So I didn't do it. Well, these guys tried four more times, but Nehemiah remained steadfast. You got to give it to him. These guys have tenacity. They have endurance. Nehemiah 6 and verse 4. Yet they sent unto me four times after this sort, and I answered them after the same manner. Four times. He says, hey, let's come down and have a meeting. Nope, I'm doing a great work. Hey, why don't we get together and have coffee? Nope, I'm doing a great work. Hey, how about you come over for dinner? Nope, I'm doing a great work. Hey, you know what? Why don't you come over to my house and we can just have a beer? Nope, I'm doing a great work. I'm not coming. Period. Most people get the message after twice. These guys are a little dense. They took a little while. It reminds me of Naomi and Ruth. When Naomi was going back to Israel after her husband had died and then her sons had died that were married to her daughters-in-law, and she told Ruth to stay in Moab. And Ruth wasn't having it. And Ruth says, whither thou goest, I will go, and thy God will be my God, and thy people my people. And when Ruth saw that, or when Naomi saw that Ruth was steadfastly minded, she left speaking unto her, it says. You got to remember that. That's important in all different areas of life. That's a good one when your family really gets on you about celebrating Christmas. Stick to your guns. It may take a year or two, but stick to your guns, and they will, if you do not compromise and you don't give in, you don't, you know, if you just say, nope, I'm not doing it, period, end of story, they will stop asking you about it. I guarantee you, they will stop asking you about it. And a lot of people in this room can probably attest to that. Well, then they tried slandering Nehemiah to scare him, but he saw through that too. So they mocked him twice, they tried to physically assault him, they tried to distract him, now they try to slander him. Verses 5 through 9. Nehemiah 6:5 through 9. Then sent Sanballat his servant unto me in like manner the fifth time with an open letter in his hand. They didn't learn the first four times. Wherein was written, it is reported among the heathen that Gashmu saith it. Now, if anybody named Gashmu says anything, you know he's lying, right? I mean, what kind of a guy is named Gashmu? That thou and the Jews think to rebel, for which cause thou buildest the wall, that thou mayest be their king according to these words. See, we see what you're up to here, Nehemiah. We know what's going on. You're trying to rebuild this wall because you want to be the king of Jerusalem. We see through your little subterfuge here. We know what's going on. Nehemiah is not going to be deterred by that. Let's keep reading. Verse 7. And thou hast also appointed prophets to preach to thee at Jerusalem, saying, there is a king in Judah. And now shall it be reported to the king according to these words. Come now, therefore, and let us take counsel together. Now, we know what you're up to, Nehemiah. You want to be the king. You've set prophets that are prophesying about you being the king. Now, let's just get together and talk, and we can just sweep this under the rug, Nehemiah. We don't want this getting out. This would be really bad PR for you. Then I sent unto him, saying, there are no such things done as thou sayest, but thou feignest them out of thine own heart. You're making stuff up, he says. You're dreaming stuff up. It's a bunch of lies. I'm not meeting with you reprobates. For they all made us afraid, saying, their hand shall be weakened from the work, that it be not done. Now therefore, O God, strengthen my hands. Nehemiah saw right through it. He wasn't afraid. He said, I'm not, your guys are lying and I'm not meeting with you. And then he prays to God again. Strengthen my hands. Well, then they hired a false prophet to try to get Nehemiah to meet him in the temple. But he likewise saw through that as well. So how many of this is mocked him twice, physically assaulted him, tried to distract him, made up lies about him, tried to slander him, and now he gets this false prophet to try to get him to meet in the temple. So at least six times they've tried to hinder this work one way or the other. Verses 10 through 14. Afterward I came unto the house, and Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabeel, who was shut up, and he said, let us meet together in the house of God, within the temple, and let us shut the doors of the temple, for they will come to slay thee. Yea, in the night they will come to slay thee. Let's get together in the temple, Nehemiah. These guys are coming to kill you. We'll get in the temple, we'll shut everything up, and we'll be safe in here. You can trust me. And I said, should such a man as I flee? And who is there that, being as I am, would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. Says, you know what? I'm not going in there. You think I'm crazy? Number one, I've got a great work to do. Number two, I don't trust you as far as I could throw you. Why would I go in the temple and shut the doors? You probably have an ambush waiting for me in there. I'm not going. Verse 12. And lo, I perceived that God had not sent him. See, Nehemiah had perception, discretion, discernment. He had wisdom. That's why it's so important to have discernment. I perceived that God had not sent him, but that he pronounced this prophecy against me, for Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. This is what you call a hireling prophet. Therefore was he hired, that I should be afraid, and do so, and sin, and that they might have matter for an evil report, that they might reproach me. My God, think thou upon Tobiah and Sanballat according to these their works, and on the prophetess Noadiah, and the rest of the prophets that would have put me in fear. He saw right through it. He denied them. And then he again prays to God. Well, despite all of the wiles of his adversaries, they finished building the wall to the disappointment of their enemies. Nehemiah 6:15-16. So the wall was finished in the 25th day of the month, Elu, in 52 days. And it came to pass that when all our enemies heard thereof, and all the heathen that were about us saw these things, they were much cast down in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was wrought of our God. They finally realize it. Wow. These little feeble Jews, the ones that we mocked, that we scorned, that we threatened, that we distracted, that we tried everything under our power, that we slandered, and yet we weren't able to stop them. And the wall is builded, and they recognized who was behind that. It was God. And if God be for us, who can be against us? Now there are some lessons that we can learn from this. Number one, if we are grieved for the suffering of God's people and pray earnestly to God, He will hear and deliver them according to His will. Remember, that's how this story started out. Nehemiah was grieved for the suffering of his people. And he took that to God, and then he took it to the king, and the Lord had mercy. The Lord delivered them by Nehemiah. Lesson number two. Sometimes deliverance is only a request away. Sometimes deliverance is only a request away. Now, Nehemiah could have thought, oh, there's no way the king's going to let me go. There's just no way. He's never going to listen to me. He's not going to hear me. He might even get mad at me. He might take my head off for even suggesting that I go to Jerusalem. There's no way. I'm not even going to ask. But you know what it says in Matthew 7:7-8? Sometimes all you got to do is ask. Matthew 7:7-8. Ask and it shall be given unto you, or it shall be given you. Seek and ye shall find, knock and it shall be opened unto you. For every one that asketh receiveth, and he that seeketh findeth, and to him that knocketh it shall be opened. Now he was asking the king, but you know what, he asked God first. Then he asked the king. James said that ye have not because ye ask not. James 4 and verse 2. James 4 and verse 2. It says, you lust and have not, you kill and desire to have and cannot obtain, you fight in war. He's writing to a church. Wouldn't you love to be a member of a church like that? Yet you have not because you ask not. And when they did ask, they asked amiss, that they might consume it upon their lust, he says in the next verse. But yeah, sometimes the reason why we don't have is because we just don't ask. We don't ask God, or we don't ask other people. You'd be amazed at what people will do for you sometimes if you just ask. Lesson number three. God can use unbelieving rulers to deliver His people. And we've seen this so many times. Nebuchadnezzar, Cyrus, I don't know if Cyrus was an unbeliever so much, but all these different Persian and Babylonian kings that delivered His people, that God used. He can still do it today also. Lesson number four. When we are doing the Lord's work, there will be adversaries. You can count on that. You can bank on it. If you're doing the Lord's work, you will have enemies. Let me give you the verse I gave you last week in 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 9. 1 Corinthians 16:9. If you don't have enemies, it's probably because you're not telling the truth, because people hate the truth. And if you tell the truth, you're going to have enemies. 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 9, for a great door and effectual is opened unto me, Paul said. And there are many adversaries. Great door, many adversaries. The bigger the door, the more the adversaries. That's how it works. Lesson number five. Our enemies will mock and scorn us to try to prevent us from doing God's work. And they do. Many of us experienced this when we were deciding to get baptized and join the church. Guess what we got from our friends and family? Mockery, scorning. You're going to join that church? You're going to join that cult? Why don't you join a real church? You know, I was told that. Why don't you go to a real church? because, you know, our church doesn't have a building and an organ, and therefore it does not qualify as a real church. To be a real church, you got to have a building and an organ, or a piano at least. Look at 1 Peter 4 and verse 14. Nothing wrong with having a building for the church to meet in. There is something wrong with having a piano and an organ, though, and I've talked about that before. 1 Peter 4 and verse 14. If ye be reproached for the name of Christ, happy are ye, for the spirit of glory and of God resteth upon you. On their part he's evil spoken of, but on your part he's glorified. See, if you're reproached for the name of Christ, you are blessed. So don't feel bad when people mock you or deride you for your faith. That's a blessing. Lesson number 6. We must be undeterred by the mocking and derision of men. You cannot let them get to you. You cannot stop doing what God has told you to do just because people are going to make fun of you or look at you weird and think you're strange. Nehemiah didn't care. He didn't care what those guys thought. He didn't care what they said. He just kept on working, kept on doing the work. We've got to do the same thing. Lesson number 7. When mocking doesn't work, our enemies will sometimes resort to physical violence. And let's hope that doesn't happen. But you know, it has happened throughout time. There have been lots of Christians who were physically assaulted, burned at the stake, and beaten and tortured. The Catholic Church did a lot of that for a long time. And it could happen again. Hopefully it doesn't. You know, Paul said to the Hebrews that ye have not yet resisted unto blood. But that doesn't mean that it won't ever happen. Lesson number... I should have numbered these things instead of lettered them. Let's see, number 8 I think it is. God will bless our efforts to defend ourselves with weapons and force when necessary. Some people think, oh, Christians should never take up arms. A Christian should never physically defend himself. That's not true. Jesus said to the disciples, he that hath no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one. He said, when I sent you out before, I sent you out without scrip and purse and staff. And basically, you just went out, you didn't have anything. He says, but now, you take that stuff. And if you don't have a sword, you sell your garment, you buy one, you take a sword. God blesses self-defense. Lesson number 9, I think it is. God helps those who help themselves. Now, who knows where that verse is in the Bible? Anybody know where that one is? God helps those that help themselves. Come on, it's the most popular verse in the Bible. Nobody knows where it is. That's because it's not in the Bible. People think it is. That one, God helps those who help themselves. Cleanliness is next to godliness. And what's the other one? I can't remember. There's like 3 verses in 3 Corinthians that people love to quote. But it is true. It's not in the Bible. Those words in that order are not in the Bible. But the concept certainly is in the Bible, that God helps those who help themselves. Nehemiah prayed to God and set a watch. If you want God's help, you better get working and help yourself. Lesson number J, I've lost track of the numbers. Our enemies will try to distract us from the work that God has called us to do. Our enemies will try to distract us from the work that God has called us to do. Just like my buddy that I was telling you about. But we cannot be distracted. Turn to 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 58. 1 Corinthians 15, 58. We've got to be steadfast, unmovable. 1 Corinthians 15:58. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as ye know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. Steadfast and unmovable. Do not be moved away. from the work that you have to do. Always abounding in the work of the Lord. You've got to keep your sights fixed on Jesus Christ and the work that He's told us to do, and don't be distracted. Nehemiah is an excellent example of that. Number K. Each of us must always remember that, quote, I am doing a great work, Nehemiah 6:3, and therefore we must not waste our time with those who would try to draw us away from it. I am doing a great work. Every time you get a temptation to be drawn off to some cause or to some thing that would take away your time from your family, from your church, from your Bible reading, from your spiritual life, or just from the work, from your job, the thing that God has actually called you to do, to work to provide for your family, whatever it is, the thing that would draw you away from the things that God has told us in the Bible that we should be doing, just remember that word, that phrase, I am doing a great work, and I cannot be distracted. And lastly, if we are diligent, the Lord will bless our work and deliver us from the attacks of our enemies. You see, Nehemiah was delivered because he was diligent. He worked hard. He trusted in God. And because of that, God blessed his enemies and God prevented his, God blessed his efforts and he prevented his enemies from being successful to stop him. Now I'm going to tell you something that is going to make you thank God. We are not going to finish this outline today. We will pick up with the next part next week, Lord willing, when we look at the seafaring men. And may God bless you until then.